Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing with Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works, and Chapter 7, Standards of Conduct and Spiritual Freedom, bottom of page 192. There are four main standards of human conduct that make an ascending scale. The first is personal need, preference, and desire. The second is the law and good of the collectivity. The third is an ideal ethic. The last is the highest divine law of the nature. Man starts on the long career of his evolution with only the first two of these four to enlighten and lead him. For they constitute the law of his animal and vital existence, and it is as the vital and physical animal man that he begins his progress. The true business of man upon earth is to express in the type of humanity a growing image of the divine, whether knowingly or unknowingly. It is to this end that nature is working in him, under the thick veil of her inner and outer processes. But the material or animal man is ignorant of the inner aim of life. He knows only its needs and its desires, and he has necessarily no other guide to what is required of him than his own perception of need and his own stirrings and pointings of desire. To satisfy his physical and vital demands and necessities, before all things else, and in the rank, whatever emotional or mental cravings or imaginations or dynamic notions rise in him, must be the first natural rule of his conduct, the sole balancing or overpowering law that can modify or contradict this pressing natural claim is the demand put on him by the ideas, needs, and desires of his family, community, or tribe, the herd, the pack, of which he is a member. If man could live to himself, and this he could only do if the development of the individual were the sole object of the divine in the world, this second law would not at all need to come into operation. But all existence proceeds by the mutual action and reaction of the whole and the parts. The need for each other of the constituents and the thing constituted, the interdependence of the group and the individuals of the group. In the language of Indian philosophy, the divine manifests himself always in the double form of the separative and the collective being, Vyasti, Samasti. Man, pressing after the growth of his separate individuality and its fullness and freedom, is unable to satisfy even his own personal needs and desires except in conjunction with other men. He is a whole in himself and yet incomplete without others. This obligation englobes his personal law of conduct in a group law, which arises from the formation of a lasting group entity with a collective mind and life, of its own, to which his own embodied mind and life are subordinated as a transitory unit. And yet is there something in him immortal and free, not bound to this group body which outlasts his own embodied existence, but cannot outlast or claim to chain by its law his eternal spirit. In itself, the seemingly larger and overriding law is no more than an extension of the vital and animal principle that governs the individual elementary man. It is the law of the pack or herd. The individual identifies partially his life with the life of a certain number of other individuals with whom he is associated by birth, choice, or circumstance. And since the existence of the group is necessary for his own existence and satisfaction, in time, if not from the first, its preservation, the fulfillment of its needs, and the satisfaction of its collective notions, desires, habits of living, without which it would not hold together, must come to take a primary place. The satisfaction of personal idea and feeling, need and desire, propensity and habit, has to be constantly subordinated by the necessity of the situation and not from any moral or altruistic motive to the satisfaction of the ideas and feelings, needs and desires, propensities and habits, not of this or that other individual or number of individuals, but of the society as a whole. This social need is the obscure matrix of morality and of man's ethical impulse. It is not actually known that in any primitive times man lived to himself, or with only his mate, as do some of the animals. All record of him shows him to us as a social animal, not an isolated body and spirit. The law of the pack has always overridden his individual law of self-development. He seems always to have been born, to have lived, to have been formed as a unit in a mass. But logically and naturally, from the psychological viewpoint, the law of personal need and desire is primary. The social law comes in as a secondary and usurping power. Man has in him two distinct master impulses, the individualistic and the communal, a personal life and a social life, a personal motive of conduct and a social motive of conduct. The possibility of their opposition and the attempt to find their equation lie at the very roots of human civilization and persist in other figures when he has passed beyond the vital animal into a highly individualized mental and spiritual progress. The existence of a social law, external to the individual, is at different times a considerable advantage and a heavy disadvantage to the development of the divine in man. It is an advantage at first when man is crude and incapable of self-control and self-finding, because it erects a power other than that of his personal egoism, through which that egoism may be induced or compelled to moderate its savage demands, to discipline its irrational and often violent movements, and even to lose itself sometimes in a larger and less personal egoism. It is a disadvantage to the adult spirit, ready to transcend the human formula, because it is an external standard which seeks to impose itself on him from outside. And the condition of his perfection is that he shall grow from within and in an increasing freedom, not by the suppression, but by the transcendence of his perfected individuality. Not any longer by a law imposed on him that trains and disciplines his members, but by the soul from within, breaking through all previous forms to possess with its light and transmute his members. In the conflict of the claims of society with the claims of the individual, two ideal and absolute solutions confront one another. There is the demand of the group that the individual should subordinate himself more or less completely, or even lose his independent existence in the community. The smaller must be immolated or self-offered to the larger unit. He must accept the need of the society as his own need, the desire of the society as his own desire. He must live not for himself, but for the tribe, clan, commune, or nation of which he is a member. The ideal, an absolute solution, from the individual standpoint, would be a society that existed not for itself, for its all-overriding collective purpose, but for the good of the individual and his fulfillment, for the greater and more perfect life of all its members. Representing as far as possible his best self, and helping him to realize it, it would respect the freedom of each of its members and maintain itself not by law and force, but by the free and spontaneous consent of its constituent persons. An ideal society of either kind does not exist anywhere and would be most difficult to create, more difficult still to keep in precarious existence, so long as individual man clings to his egoism as the primary motive of existence. A general but not complete domination of the society over the individual is the easier way. And it is the system that nature, from the first, instinctively adopts and keeps in equilibrium by rigorous law. Compelling custom and a careful indoctrination of the still subservient and ill-developed intelligence of the human creature. In primitive societies, the individual life is submitted to rigid and immobile communal custom and rule. This is the ancient and would-be eternal law of the human pack that tries always to masquerade as the everlasting decree of the imperishable. Esha Dharma Sanatana. And the ideal is not dead in the human mind. The most recent trend of human progress is to establish an enlarged and sumptuous edition of this ancient turn of collective living towards the enslavement of the human spirit. There is here a serious danger to the integral development of a greater truth upon earth and a greater life. For the desires and free seekings of the individual, however egoistic, however false or perverted they may be in their immediate form, contain in their obscure shell the seed of a development necessary to the whole. His searchings and stumblings have behind them a force that has to be kept and transmuted into the image of the divine ideal. That force needs to be enlightened and trained, but must not be suppressed or harnessed exclusively to society's heavy cartwheels. Individualism is as necessary to the final perfection as the power behind the group spirit. The stifling of the individual may well be the stifling of the God in man. And in the present balance of humanity, there is seldom any real danger of exaggerated individualism breaking up the social integer. There is continually a danger that the exaggerated pressure of the social mass, by its heavy, unenlightened mechanical weight, may suppress or unduly discourage the free development of the individual spirit. For man, in the individual, can be more easily enlightened, conscious, open to clear influences. Man in the mass is still obscure, half-conscious, ruled by universal forces that escape its mastery and its knowledge. Against this danger of suppression and immobilization, nature in the individual reacts. It may react by an isolated resistance, ranging from the instinctive and brutal revolt of the criminal to the complete negation of the solitary and ascetic. It may react by the assertion of an individualistic trend in the social idea, may impose it on the mass consciousness and establish a compromise between the individual and the social demand. But a compromise is not a solution. It only salves over the difficulty, and in the end increases the complexity of the problem and multiplies its issues. A new principle has to be called in, other and higher than the two conflicting instincts, and powerful at once to override and to reconcile them. Above the natural individual law, which sets up as our one standard of conduct the satisfaction of our individual needs, preferences, and desires, and the natural communal law, which sets up as a superior standard the satisfaction of the needs, preferences, and desires of the community as a whole, there had to arise the notion of an ideal moral law, which is not the satisfaction of need and desire, but controls and even coerces or annuls them in the interest of an ideal order that is not animal, not vital and physical, but mental, a creation of the mind's seeking for light and knowledge and right rule and right movement and true order. The moment this notion becomes powerful in man, he begins to escape from the engrossing vital and material into the mental life. He climbs from the first to the second degree of the threefold ascent of nature. His needs and desires themselves are touched with a more elevated light of purpose, and the mental need, the aesthetic, intellectual, and emotional desire begin to predominate over the demand of the physical and vital nature. Stopping today at the bottom of page 197.